You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. In this episode of PX Pulse, we'll be talking to AVAC's former Director of Strategy and Content, Emily Bass, about her new book, To End a Plague, America's Fight to End AIDS in Africa. It's a comprehensive history of PEPFAR, short for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Emily began reporting for this book not long after George W. Bush launched the program in 2003, and it would go on to mark enormous achievements. Here's a few numbers. It delivered life-saving drugs preventing infection in nearly 3 million babies, treated more than 17 million more people who live with HIV. It brought HIV testing to 50 million people. It trained 300,000 new health workers. These are just a few of the numbers. But the challenges have been enormous, too. Emily has been following the program since its inception and explores the highs and the lows, including questions related to health equity, drug costs, patents, foreign aid, and why PEPFAR was uniquely able to sustain support across the political spectrum year in and year out. So I started by asking, what made PEPFAR different?
So there are a few things that really made PEPFAR different. It had an extraordinary amount of money behind it.
$15 billion over 5 years to PEPFAR.
Yes. And PEPFAR had enormous amount of presidential support. It had political will. This was a White House that was deeply committed to doing things differently. And they were really, really in particular invested in this idea of impact. So it really was, there was a desire to do things differently. There was a willingness to spend a lot of money. And then there was something to spend money on. And it's really, this is where the story widens beyond the White House. There were antiretrovirals. And the antiretrovirals were affordable because of a ferocious, impassioned activist movement of Philadelphia anarchists and South Africans living with HIV and Brazilians living with HIV and Thai drug users living with HIV and ACT UP New York, who would not let profits be prioritized over people's lives.
And we're going to talk more about this too, but for now, that pressure results in prices coming down.
Yes, drug prices come down, and that's why the amount of money that PEPFAR has to spend can pay for the drugs. So those two things together are really where you get this moment of potential for enormous change.
So it's a moment of great potential. Looking back, how did you see it then? And what questions were driving you in your reporting?
When Bush, so I remember watching the State of the Union and I cried. And the next day, the AIDS activists that were my mentors and friends and exes and my community were furious. They didn't believe him. They didn't believe that it was going to do anything. They thought it was a political ploy. And I wanted to believe that it was going to work. Why I wanted that, why it was a really contrarian impulse. I wanted to be allowed to think that it was going to work. And I had been part of an activist movement that had been fighting for this, and we'd gotten it, and yet the message was it wasn't actually what we wanted. It piqued my interest. Like, this is a lot of what we wanted, and yet now we're starting to say things about how foreign aid should work. So I had those two things. But it was really just like, I want to see for myself.
Right. So let's turn now to the opening chapters of the book. You are wrestling with a contradiction. PEPFAR was promising to work fast and save lives on U.S. terms. But activists are interested in big transformation, the kinds of change that'll address systemic inequities, things that make people vulnerable in the first place. PEPFAR wasn't offering this, no big investments in a country's existing health system, for example. This trade-off continued to be tested and to play out over the years. You describe some groups, South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign, and some LGBTQ rights groups that are trying to do both. But you say in your book, quote, there was a choice between fighting the virus or rooting out the causes of the epidemic. I'm wondering, what drives this tension? What's your sense of it? Why can't both happen at once on a larger scale. Why can't you save lives and invest in a country's infrastructure or demand the right policies or fund the right interventions all at the same time?
You know, in hindsight, there is a both and possibility. But at the time that PEPFAR is launched, there are fewer than 50,000 people living with HIV who are on antiretrovirals in sub-Saharan Africa. And the death rate is staggering. And the need to begin to, and there are millions of people living with HIV, and the need to get drugs into bodies is one of the activist slogans. The need to get pills to people is paramount, and it's undeniable. You're losing the productive generation. You're losing the parents, the teachers, the nurses, the engineers. You're losing a generation. And the most important thing you can do is, if you want to stop dying, is to move the treatment programs, scale them up really fast. In South Africa, which had a raging epidemic, is the epicenter of the epidemic when PEPFAR starts, in sub-Saharan Africa, the president questions whether HIV is a causative agent for AIDS, will not endorse a national HIV treatment plan, will not take a two-pill regimen that prevents transmission from mothers to infants to scale. And so then the question becomes, do you work with that government and wait for that government to shift its policies and its programs, or do you do what PEPFAR and South African clinicians did, which is essentially to team up and begin to work incredibly fast with anybody who is willing to do it. Okay, that's an example of where you have to make a choice. Who, what, and the history of why somebody like Thabo Mbeki, you know, who is a resistance fighter, an incredibly educated person, and the president of South Africa at the time, would take a stance which ultimately cost hundreds of thousands of lives. It's an inexcusable stance, but it is worth understanding where those kinds of stances come from. Why do you distrust Western medicine? Why are you not interested in... This is a country that has also been sued by the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association of America, aided and abetted by the Clinton-Gore administration's U.S. trade representatives for trying to have the right to import or obtain essential medicine. So it's a complex negotiation. Those are some of the tensions, and PEPFAR was ready to get off the ground. Many governments had been doing very little. The groups that had been doing work were NGOs, and they were ready to go because they had been building support groups, building choirs and dance groups and all the things you did while you were waiting for treatment. And so the groups that were ready were not governmental groups, and PEPFAR made a really profound and decisive choice to go with the groups that were ready.
I want to turn now to the role of activists. You describe in the book South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign and other African feminists and people living with HIV who were leading movements, many of them linked up with American or other international allies. Before reading your book, I assumed the influence of activism was really well understood. I found myself really surprised to learn that the impact that activists were having has not been recognized in the history. You talk about how global leaders, politicians, and scientists haven't properly understood or credited these movements. So when and how did activists have the greatest impact? When did they really change the course of the global response in a way that's not yet understood the way you think it should be?
I mean, when Bush announced PEPFAR, January 28th, 2003, State of the Union, he quoted a price for the AIDS medications, right? The drugs are now, I mean, it was basically a dollar a day at that point. That passage is quoted in the legislation that created PEPFAR, and that price is redacted. Those words were redacted. The price that he quoted was the result of one of the single most effective anti-capitalist interventions in my lifetime. You had a group of people that essentially said, and this is all extremely relevant to COVID-19, we are going to understand who paid for these drugs to be developed, who's setting the prices, who can make them cheaper, and what's preventing people who can make them cheaper from selling them. So you have to get the prices to come down, and you have to prove that people who are poor and people who are Black and brown can take them. And so these two things are happening, and they are propelled by activists, by people living with HIV who become peer educators, who are willing to disclose their status, some of whom die, doctors and nurses and people who administer tests willing to treat them. And at the same time, you have this incredibly technical analysis of trade-related intellectual property and compulsory licensing, these provisions that allow countries to either make or obtain cheaper versions of essential medications. And you have a very smart media campaign that essentially makes it morally impossible and reprehensible for these drug companies to keep their prices where they are, even though the people that are impacted by this price are Black and brown people living in poor countries who have, most of them, a sexually transmitted disease. And yet it becomes morally reprehensible for the prices to be as high as they are. And it is so dangerous and so potent, they couldn't put the prices in the legislation.
For fear they would alienate the drug companies.
That's how potent it is, right? And you cannot have PEPFAR. $15 billion over 5 years doesn't buy you anything if the drug regimens are $12,000 a year.
So the activists in South Africa, Brazil, the U.S., around the world, are playing this instrumental role in applying pressure to bring down drug prices.
And in demonstrating that it was possible to treat people. And in creating these clinics. In Uganda, it was a group of people living with HIV who worked with an international group called AIDS SETI that collected donated medications. And they would have a meeting and they would decide who among them could have the 7 courses of medication that had been donated, right? And then those medications were then administered by clinics that were treating people with HIV at the time. But those people who received the medications were proof that poor Black and brown people could in fact take HIV meds and do okay. Because one of the things the drug companies loved to say for a long time is, even if we backed a truckload of pills up, they would say that over and over, a truckload of pills, that wouldn't fix everything. And you have these small clinics that are basically offering a very small counterfactual. And that and the price drop, both of which are activist interventions, make PEPFAR possible.
Got it. I want to turn now to the subject of Deborah Birx. Readers are going to get to know Deb Birx better in your book. She headed up PEPFAR as its ambassador from 2014 to 2021, and you describe her successful, unprecedented use of data and targets to bring treatment and prevention where it's most needed to have the biggest impact. Many folks will know Deb Birx's name from Donald Trump's coronavirus task force. Her work for the Trump administration has drawn criticism from the press and the global health community, sometimes intense criticism. What do you want readers to take away from your book about Deborah Birx?
What she did with PEPFAR needs to be part of her legacy and needs to be understood in all of its detail, because it is the single best example we have right now of an attempt to use data-driven, target-driven, hands-on from the U.S. approach to achieving epidemic control, to controlling epidemics, to ending an epidemic. And we are going to need to do that. COVID is not going to go off like a light switch. Other pandemics are not going to go off like a light switch. And so the question of what does it mean? What does it take? What do you pay for? And what do you ask for if you are trying to not just treat people so they stop, don't die, but actually end epidemic levels of new infections? That question is hard to answer. And Ambassador Birx and her team, they provide an example. We need to understand that.
So it's a model that deserves to be looked at closely.
Yes. You know, she saved more lives. There's no question she saved more lives.
You report on some of those lives up close. There are several people you profile over the years. And I'd like you to read a passage from one of those profiles. It's about Tata. He is the father of a family where he and his wife and baby are HIV positive, and they get treatment for the first time because of PEPFAR, but they continue to live in poverty. Another daughter acquires HIV. And when you go back to visit them in 2009, this daughter tells you the story of Tata's death and his burial.
Tata had been buried in the same home village to which he'd brought his newborn daughter 3 years prior. A mighty storm swept through on the day of his burial, a great violent wind that had brought down a huge tree amid the mourners. I imagined it, a vestige of the whirlwind that had once swept mercy into their country, their home, Tata taking leave with an elemental power or a manifestation of the community's collective grief. It was none of those things, though. The tree had nearly killed Mama Apollo when it fell. It was the weather of a random and capricious world in which some people died and others survived for no apparent reason.
This resonated for me when I read it, with the anger of the activists, the questions you come to again and again between fighting the virus versus rooting out the causes of the epidemic. So where are you with that question now?
So it's the beginning and the end of what pills can do. They return you to life, but the kind of life that they return you to is determined by factors far beyond what this particular movement achieved victory with. I mean, we talked about antiretrovirals as being the thin edge of the wedge or the crowbar in the crack. The idea was that when people realized that they could get this thing and we could redress this inequity, that other things would happen. Where I'm at with that now is that feels very, like, that's an essential thing to believe in. And it's hard to remember a time when that felt as live as it really did. That this was going to be the beginning, and people were going to rise up and demand other things. The prices fell at a moment of an intense, powerful anti-globalization movement that was taking on other things. It was looking at debt relief. It was looking at stopping environmental degradation. It was looking at a range of issues, and the state responded swiftly and brutally. September 11th, 2001, everything changes, right? Activists are terrorists. Everybody's a terrorist. Every brown person, you know, the whole architecture changes, and AIDS events, anti-globalization events that are planned are called off, and then everybody is trying to figure out if they're actually now just going to do anti-war stuff. So the global treatment movement was part of a larger movement. It is actually a moment where a lot was in the balance, and we can see right now the work that was left undone and the impact of it.
With that in mind, what's the status of PEPFAR today? What should we hope for it? What do we want from it?
So PEPFAR, through the pandemic, it managed to innovate and pivot and keep people on treatment and get PrEP, which is a daily oral pill that prevents HIV, to clients. And it really pushed, in some countries, it really pushed models of service delivery beyond what the country policy environment was. And it moved fast, and it worked to meet targets and to stop catastrophe. And in many instances, it did. And this is still the problem when you have a system that is not working and you have an intervention that is. Even if that intervention is bilateral and neoliberal, at certain moments, it is the thing that is stopping people from going to the pharmacy and finding that there's no meds. And at that moment, you want the drugs on the shelves, even though the more you push the moment where you reckon with why the system sucks down the road, you know, the longer it's but it stepped into the breach. The breach is bigger than PEPFAR. The ground that has been lost in HIV, in TB, in preventing unintended pregnancies, in contraception. I mean, we are just losing ground in hard-fought battles, and we are against a range of diseases and in the fight for universal health care. And I fear that we will continue to lose that unless we all understand that risk of the next pandemic, our ability to stave it off, is tied to the success of finishing the work that PEPFAR and the Global Fund and countries started, which is really building resilient health systems that treat people in a rights-based context, that allow women to have bodily autonomy, that allow people to have sex when and with whom they want to, that do not criminalize people who use drugs. I mean, we are not done. And that work is not a separate story from the work of preventing pandemics. So PEPFAR needs to be fully funded. It needs more funding, and it needs to continue to do what it's really done best over the years, I think, which is to innovate and to identify the ways that programs can do those things that I was talking about, and then have those programs be run and owned by whoever in the country is able to do it. And it may not be the government. It might be NGOs. So its work is not done.
Well, Emily, as a fellow AVACer, we are delighted to be talking to you about your book, To End a Plague. Available now and published by Public Affairs. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our interview with Emily Bass. Emily is an activist and author. She has been AVAC's Director of Strategy and Content. And now, after 15 years, Emily will be leaving AVAC for new challenges and opportunities in the fight for global health. Here at PX Pulse, we wish her luck and success. We will miss you, Emily. You've been listening to PX Pulse, recorded in the New York City studios of the Radio Foundation and the Relic Room. Our theme music was composed by Alexi Stevens. Our engineer is Sam Baer.